From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
The world is a carousel of color. Wonderful, wonderful color. The world is a carousel of color.
Walt Disney influenced the way children see the world. He could be corny and nostalgic, but he could also be innovative, even futuristic. On today's Fresh Air, Walt Disney and how he reshaped American popular culture. We talk with Neil Gabler about his new biography of Disney. Also, David Bianculli reviews the return of the British crime drama Cracker, and rock historian Ed Ward pays tribute to the late R&B pioneer Floyd Dixon. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Magic mirror on the wall, who is the fairest one of all?
That's the Wicked Queen in Walt Disney's 1937 classic Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, the first feature-length animated film. My guest Neil Gabler has written a new book about Disney and how he reshaped our popular culture and the American consciousness. Disney reinvented animation with characters like Mickey Mouse, and with Disneyland, reconceptualized the amusement park as theme park. He recognized the importance of television at its start with the Mickey Mouse Club and helped bring color to TV through his program, The Wonderful World of Color. While many of his movies offered a nostalgic view of history, Disney also looked to the future with Tomorrowland and Epcot. My guest Neil Gabler is also the author of the books Winchell, Gossip, Power, and the Culture of Celebrity, and An Empire of Their Own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood. I told Gabler that I was surprised to read in his new book that despite Disney's many successes, several of his early animated classics originally lost money.
Yes, that was surprising to me, too. I just assumed when I embarked on this project that, you know, all of these films were enormously successful and the money was just pouring in. And in point of fact, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs was enormously successful. It brought so much money to the studio that he was actually able to build a new studio in Burbank, California, where Walt Disney Productions is still headquartered. But after Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, film after film after film lost money, and rather than bring enormous amounts of money into the studio, they poured enormous amounts of money out of the studio. Pinocchio was a disaster. Fantasia, an even bigger disaster. Bambi was a disaster. The only one of that run of films that we regard now as the classic Disney animations that made any money was Dumbo, and that made money because it was done very cheaply. It was much less expensive than the other animations. It was animated, it was produced for roughly $600,000, and that was done intentionally because the studio desperately needed an inexpensive film that they could get some kind of profitable return on, and Dumbo happened to do that. But then from Bambi to Cinderella, you know, there were no feature animations made because the studio simply could not afford to do them. And there was an awfully long period of time where the studio said, you know, we can't make feature animations. We're just going to have to end that whole idea of making feature animations because there is no way, given how labor-intensive these films are, that one could finally make a profit on them.
But I guess once the baby boom generation was born and started going to the movies, those old movies started to make a profit.
Yes, well, Walt always thought, it's funny, Terry, he always said, you know, I don't care if these movies make a profit now. And he really meant that. He didn't care. Walt had a very kind of cavalier attitude towards money. He said, but these films will eventually make a lot of money. You'll see. We'll re-release them. That was always an intention of his, to re-release the films. You know, it worked out that he re-released them every 7 years. And then they also, you know, exploited the television potential of those films when he had the Disneyland series. But he always thought, in the long run, they'll make money. And that was a characteristic of Walt's. Walt never thought short term. He was always thinking long term. It was always about the looking to the horizon, and not at, you know, what was directly in front of you.
Walt Disney in the 50s, you know, Uncle Walt, as a lot of people grew up knowing him, had a very conservative image. As you describe it in the book, he was the personification of traditional values and square aesthetics. And yet earlier in the book, you say when he came to Hollywood, he loved dress up and make believe. He was boisterous, outgoing, self-aggrandizing, histrionic. So was the conservative image just part of his, like another costume for him, or was he really that conservative deep down?
In some ways, it was a costume. I mean, the early Walt Disney, I think, as you very accurately portray it, was flamboyant. I mean, he was an innovator. He was a subversive. The early Mickey Mouse cartoons, you know, were clearly patterned after Charlie Chaplin's comedies. And little Mickey Mouse was a kind of a scamp. I mean, he was a subversive. He was a guy who was always poking and prodding and pulling and defying authority. And Walt was kind of that way, too, at least artistically speaking. And it was one of the ways that he gained an enormous artistic cachet in the 1930s. I mean, intellectuals loved Walt Disney because they saw him as this naive, artless artist. This guy who wasn't, you know, all full of pretension. He was completely unpretentious. There was a really plebeian quality to Walt Disney. Now, as time went on and he became more successful, in some ways he became a victim of his success. He became kind of the image of America to much of the world, and Walt began to take that seriously. He understood that he was being imprisoned by that image. Walt never fooled himself that he was really Walt Disney. And in point of fact, that is the Walt Disney that you described, the avuncular Walt Disney. And he actually had said, you know, I'm not Walt Disney. You know, Walt Disney is a thing.
Well, you know, in talking about what Walt Disney's personality really was like, you describe him as very obsessive, driven, and often unhappy.
Yes.
We had two breakdowns. What were they about?
Well, the first breakdown, which he himself has described in a series of interviews that he gave to his daughter and which were later put into a book called The Story of Walt Disney, happened in the early 1930s when he was making the Mickey Mouse cartoons. And he found himself unaccountably crying all the time, unable to sleep, desperately unhappy, deep, deep depression. And he attributed it finally to the fact that the Mickey Mouse animations were never good as good on screen as they were when he imagined them in his head. And he just couldn't tolerate that. Now, the second breakdown happened in the post-war period when, again, having made these great, you know, feature animations, he came to the conclusion that he could never make animations that were anywhere near as good as the golden age of animations, the films that he made during that golden age, the Snow Whites, Pinocchio, Dumbo, whatever, that they're simply financially that wasn't viable anymore. And the form that this sort of breakdown took was that he retreated and he became obsessed, not with a studio, not with animations, but with model trains. He built model trains. He would actually go to the machine shop of the studio and build these trains. He laid track around his house and would put on an engineer's cap and ride the trains. He was just absolutely, completely, 24/7 absorbed by model trains.
Well, you did use the word obsessive.
That he was.
Why did Disney develop an animation studio? Had he been an animator himself before creating his own studio?
No, he was an artist, a commercial artist. And interestingly, he formed the studio when he was very, very young. You know, Walt Disney died when he was only 65 years old. And most of his accomplishments happened when he was a very young man. So he was living in Kansas City, working at a studio that made animated advertisements to be shown before motion pictures. And this was in the early 1920s. And he became so absorbed, as always, with making these, with drawing these animations, that he decided he wanted to draw longer ones. And that ultimately expanded into his quitting his job and forming, at the age of 20 years old, his own animation studio in Kansas City. And he signed on a young man who also had an interest in animation, and what he offered was they would learn how to do this together. So that was his very first animation studio. Now, that animation studio didn't last very long. He signed a very poor contract. The company with which he signed the contract ultimately went bankrupt, and his own company, which was called Laugh-O-Gram Films, also went bankrupt. And so that ultimately was the spur for his going to Hollywood.
You know, in talking about his, like Disney's sense of wanting perfection in the world yet being unable to achieve it, I'm reminded, of course, of Disneyland. And, you know, one of the ways you describe Disney in your book is as being, along with Norman Rockwell, the leading avatar of small-town flag-waving America. And, you know, he invented the theme park, he invented Disneyland. And Disneyland is this combination of fantasy in the rides and this kind of, like, idealized small-town America in its streets. Did that vision of, like, Disneyland connect to anything in his childhood? Did he actually have an idealized hometown like that?
Yes, he did. I mean, he came by that Disneyland vision, particularly the Main Street that is the entrance to Disneyland and to Walt Disney World as well. He came by that very honestly because when he was very young, he was born in Chicago. but his parents moved when he was a very young boy to a small farm community called Marceline in Missouri. And Walt Disney, throughout his entire life, though he only lived there for 5 years, throughout his entire life, he always regarded Marceline, Missouri as kind of the touchstone. That was the idol of his life. That was where he had his best times. That was the place, he later said, that had more to do with shaping him than any other community. And, you know, I don't want to be Freudian about this or overly psychological about it, but I think one could certainly make the case that throughout his life, Walt Disney was always trying to find some way back to the security, the beauty, the enjoyment that he had in Marceline, Missouri.
God, I hear you talk about this, and I'm thinking Rosebud.
Oh, yes.
I'm thinking Susan Cain.
Marceline is the Rosebud of Walt Disney's life.
We have a lot of interesting information about the creation of Disneyland in your book. And you say that, you know, Disney saw it as kind of like a series of cute movie sets, and some of it was built on like a three-quarter scale. So everything was three-quarters of the size that it would have been in real life. Why did he do that?
We did it for a number of reasons, but one of the most interesting reasons to me is Walt Disney really abhorred the notion of monumentalism. And he actually, you know, talked about, you know, Nazi monuments that were always oversized and that, you know, he thought, you know, kind of dwarfed people. And what he wanted to do was empower people. So he thought, you know, if you make a theme park that is actually a smaller scale, not only will people feel that it's kind of a toy, and there's something fanciful about it because it's smaller, but they will also feel empowered. And Disneyland has an awful lot to do, as does all of Walt Disney's work, as a matter of fact, with this notion of empowerment.
My guest is Neil Gabler. His new book is called Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Neil Gabler, and his new book is a biography of Walt Disney. One of Disney's greatest legacies is, of course, Mickey Mouse. And, you know, he helps to create Mickey Mouse very early in his career. And, of course, Mickey Mouse still survives today. And, you know, there's the Mickey Mouse Club. There's marketing around the world of Mickey Mouse things. So let's just begin with the creation of Mickey Mouse. Like, who were the brains behind it?
Well, there were really two brains behind Mickey Mouse. Mickey Mouse happened because Walt Disney created another character, Oswald the Rabbit, and had that character taken away from him by Universal Pictures, who was the distributor of his animations. And he had a showdown with his distributor in New York, lost that showdown, and was on a train ride back to California and realized he had nothing. Not only had the character been taken away from him, but the distributor had also hired away most of his animators behind his back. So now Walt Disney was in the position of having to start from scratch. And on that train ride, as the story goes, you know, he said he came up with the idea of a mouse as a character and actually even wrote a brief scenario and brought that back to Los Angeles with him. That's one story. Ub Iwerks, who was Walt Disney's chief animator at that time, and a longtime collaborator with Walt, going all the way back to Kansas City, told a different story. He was a man of few words, but in one interview, he said, that's really not the way it happened. What happened was that Walt got back from New York. We sat around and tried to determine what kind of character might work on screen. Cats had already been done. Obviously, they'd had a rabbit prior to this period. So they hit upon doing a mouse, which was patterned after a mice that had been drawn by an artist by the name of Clifford Meek, who was wrote for humor magazines or drew pictures for humor magazines. I think the interesting thing about the early Mickey Mouse is that Mickey Mouse is really bipolar. On the one hand, Walt Disney always saw Mickey Mouse as being a kind of Charlie Chaplin figure, as I said earlier, and Ub Iwerks saw him as a kind of Douglas Fairbanks figure. So almost from his inception, Mickey Mouse was kind of oscillating between these two sides, the heroic Douglas Fairbanks side and the impish Charlie Chaplin side. And in fact, I don't think he was ever able to resolve those two very disparate halves of himself. And it was one of the elements, among many, that contributed to his demise. Because though you say, you know, well, Mickey Mouse still exists, and he does still exist, he exists now essentially as a corporate logo, mm-hmm. as an image. Mm-hmm. But he does not exist as a character.
No, as you say in your book, through Disney, you can see the interplay of art and commerce in America. And you could certainly see that through Mickey Mouse, because as you say, Mickey Mouse became like a logo for the Disney company and has been marketed in every way imaginable and synergized, you know, the Mickey Mouse Club on TV, Mickey Mouse in the theme parks. Who was behind that? You described someone named Herman K. Kamen,
yes,
as being the merchandising genius of
He was the merchandising
Disney.
Genius. I mean, the very first Mickey Mouse product was a paper tablet with Mickey Mouse's picture on it. And Walt, I think, got paid $300 for that when he was in a New York hotel. And somebody came up to him and said, you know, I'd like to put Mickey Mouse's image on this tablet and I'll give you a little bit of money for it. But Walt had already been looking at the enormous merchandising that surrounded Felix the Cat, who was the preeminent animation figure before Mickey Mouse. And he wanted to get a part of that swag himself. And the way he got it was by calling a man by the name of Herman K. Kamen, who had a business that essentially conducted department store promotions. Kamen immediately came to Los Angeles. He was based in Kansas City, Walt's old hometown, and said, I can make you a lot of money with Mickey Mouse. And that's exactly what he did. And that association lasted for 17 years until Kay Kamen died in an airplane accident. And he made enormous amounts of money, operating on somewhat the same principle that Walt Disney did. That is, finding partners, merchandising partners, who were very high quality, very upscale, who wouldn't compromise the quality of the Mickey Mouse product, which is exactly how Walt saw his own animations. And, you know, they reaped tremendous, tremendous profits. At times, much more from the merchandise than they were getting from the films themselves. That is, the Mickey Mouse shorts themselves.
One of Disney's geniuses was getting into television when television was still really young and getting a real foothold there. So he did well with his programs. That helped with the merchandising of his products. That helped sell his movies. I mean, it just helped in every way.
Yes.
Why did he have faith in television at a time, I think, when a lot of people didn't?
You know, Walt, for all the small-town 19th-century qualities that he had and all those 19th-century values that he seemed to purvey, he was also, oddly enough and seemingly contradictorily, you know, a very visionary figure who loved technology, promoted space on his Disneyland television series. But what happened with Disneyland was that, I mean, Walt had long had an interest in television. And actually, at one point, it pondered buying television stations in the post-war period. But when he came to build Disneyland, or wanted to build Disneyland, he had one major problem, a problem that had dogged him essentially all of his life, surprisingly. He had no money. Walt Disney needed money. And all the time he had planned the park, he really hadn't given a great deal of thought to how he was going to finance the park. And it was an enormous venture, you know, even in those days, and required enormous amounts of capital, some $17 million. And the plan that he hit upon to finance the theme park was he was going to sign a deal, which he ultimately did, with ABC, which was the third of the major networks and which desperately needed programming. And as part of that deal, he agreed to do a television series, which ABC believed would be enormously successful. They were right. It was a ratings champion. But ABC also agreed to put a fairly large stake in the theme park and to underwrite loans to the theme park. So Walt Disney exchanged the television series for financing for the theme park. And in point of fact, you know, each individual episode of the show lost enormous amounts of money, just as the feature animations did, with the exception of Snow White. But he understood that the television show was a great promotional vehicle both for the theme park and for the feature animations. It was like getting an hour commercial for both, you know, every week.
You tell a lot of interesting stories about the creation of the Mickey Mouse Club. You say that Walt Disney wanted kids on that show who looked like real kids. He didn't want professional actors. He wanted the kids to be cast from schoolyards. Did it actually work out
that way? Yes, it did. Actually, he sent, you know, Bill Walsh, who was the producer of the show, to schoolyards, and he said, this is what you've got to do. I don't want all these professional kids, you know, these kids who can all tap dance and have bright smiles and Shirley Temple hair. I don't want that. Go to a schoolyard and watch the kids who kind of everybody gravitates around. You'll see who has charisma. We can teach them all of these talent skills, but essentially, you can't teach charisma. And that is how they went and recruited a lot of the kids. These kids were not all, you know, professionals with professional smiles and professional talents. They taught them those things.
Neil Gabler is the author of the new book, Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
We're the Mouseketeers. We want to say hello and give three cheers for all of you who see us every day. You're okay, so welcome to our Mouse Club. And by the way, while you're here, you're all the guests of the Merry Mouseketeers. We'd like to introduce ourselves to you, so proudly put on your Mouseketeers. It's time to meet the Mouseketeers.
Roll call.
Cheryl.
Bobby.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's Complete Sherlock Holmes, in stores and online at bn.com. And from Casey Family Programs, a national foundation working to improve the lives of the 800,000 children who experience foster care every year, at casey.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose, at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Neil Gabler about the life and work of Walt Disney. TV critic David Bianculli reviews the return of the British crime drama Cracker, and rock historian Ed Ward remembers R&B pioneer Floyd Dixon. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Neil Gabler, author of the new book, Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination. In addition to having written several earlier books about movies and American popular culture, Gabler is a regular panelist on the Fox News program Fox News Watch. It features two liberals and two conservatives commenting on the media. Gabler is one of the liberals. Walt Disney is such a key figure in American popular culture. One of the chapters of his life that you explore in the TV was his testimony before HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee, during the anti-communist hunting era. Why did he testify before HUAC at a time when some people declined to testify or to name names? Why did he testify and what did he have to say?
You know, I'd said that he was non-ideological, And I think that's absolutely true. But in 1941, the studio, the Burbank studio that he had built on the proceeds of Snow White, and which he tried to make into a worker's paradise, a utopia, that studio was struck by the Screen Cartoonists Guild. It was a very bitter strike, even more bitter because Walt had a very paternalistic attitude and thought, you know, here I created this paradise on Earth, and I'd worked with all of these people for years, and we had this wonderful camaraderie, and now they've destroyed everything. The strike lasted from May until September, when it was finally settled, not on terms favorable to Walt. In fact, the National Labor Reconciliation Board essentially forced Walt to settle. But Walt always felt, and this was really his kind of political baptism, Walt had always felt that the strike had been instigated by communists who were out to get Walt Disney, in part because he was a representative of American culture. And that animus never left him. Now, he wasn't entirely, paranoid. There were communists deeply involved in the union. And it may have actually been the case that the union was out to get Walt Disney. But in any case, in the post-war period, when Walt was called to testify, he happily did so, really on the basis that, you know, he was getting back at the people who had destroyed everything he had built. So he was angry. And when he testified, though he wasn't quite as virulent in his denunciations as some of those who testified, nevertheless, I mean, he did tell the committee that he believed that communists had instigated the strike and tried to destroy his studio, and that Herbert Sorrell, who was the head of the union, had said that, or head of the umbrella to which the union belonged, the umbrella group, said that he was going to turn the Disney studio into a dust bowl. That was part of Disney's testimony that day.
Did he name names beyond the head of the union?
No, he did not. No, because, you know, ultimately, he had no basis for accusing anybody of anything, since, you know, the person who he hated most was Art Babbitt, who was a longtime animator. Actually, he had animated the Mushrooms in Fantasia. And Art Babbitt had taken on to head the union at the Disney studio. But as much as Walt Disney hated Art Babbitt, you know, no one could have really made the accusation that Art Babbitt was a communist, and he wasn't. So he really didn't name names except in misspeaking. And he misspoke by accusing the League of Women Voters of being a communist front that had attacked him during the strike. And it was very hard for him to pull back from that. He kept on insisting afterwards that the League of Women Voters had somehow conspired to destroy the studio, when it turned out it was another organization called the League of Women Shoppers. And Walt finally was forced to say, no, it wasn't the League of Women Voters, it was the League of Women Shoppers, and I apologize.
Neil, can you tell us something wonderful and surprising that you found in the Disney archive while doing research for the book?
You know, there's no smoking gun in this book in the sense that, you know, you're gonna find, oh, Walt Disney was gay? I didn't know that. Or, you know, that's not going to happen, and I know I'll probably disappoint some readers, because I like to think that the entire life is a revelation. You know, I think, you know, his relationship with his family is somewhat interesting, because, you know, Walt, being a perfectionist and being someone who is obsessed with his studio, spent a lot more time at his studio than he ever spent with his family. And a very testy relationship with his wife. I mean, one of the surprises for me is that the individual who seemed to believe least in Walt Disney's visions, the individual who told him, nobody will see dwarves, dwarves are ugly, they'll be put off by dwarves, the person who told him, why in the world do you want to build Disneyland? What in the world are you thinking? Who's going to go to a theme park? That individual was his wife. And as Walt said to one employee who came to him asking for more money because he said his wife told him they needed more money, Walt said, your wife? Do you know where I would be if I listened to my wife? He was right, by the way.
One more question. You used to be a film critic. And
yes, I was.
I'm sure you went back and watched all of the Disney movies and probably a lot TV shows, too. What did you see that you had never noticed before? Is there one cartoon or one show or movie that you saw very differently now than you did when you saw it when you were younger, or when you saw it when, you know, when you were a young man, before you were researching Disney in depth like this?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, I was somewhat surprised in watching Pollyanna again. Pollyanna has a very kind of caustic streak in it about small-town values, small-town hypocrisy. It promotes progressive values. It takes on religion. And that's somewhat surprising when one thinks of Walt Disney. And another thing that, you know, I didn't surprise me, but that I felt more strongly on what must have been my 10th viewing of the film, was what an amazing achievement Pinocchio is. You know, I don't make value judgments in the book about the quality of the films, but, you know, you watch Pinocchio, which is a film of such great sophistication, a film that is so dark in so many ways, betraying the image of Walt Disney as being the master of lightness. That is a film that just, you know, continues to astonish me, and astonished me again, you know, watching it as I was researching the book.
Yeah, and you say that Disney suggested the idea of Jiminy Cricket as Pinocchio's conscience because he thought Pinocchio was maybe too dark.
Yes, I mean, the problem with Pinocchio was, how is anybody going to like this puppet? This puppet is mean. And this puppet is easily, you know, moved to do things that, you know, a hero of a film doesn't do. And it was Walt who finally said, you know, we're going to take that Cricket figure who exists in the book, and Walt is and whom Pinocchio actually stomps upon. We're going to take that figure, and we're going to turn him into the conscience. So he's constantly reminding Pinocchio of what Pinocchio ought to be doing. Well, of course, that innovation is the innovation that makes the entire film, you know, cohere. And by the way, I should add that that kind of innovation that Walt came up with was not atypical. That was actually fairly typical of what Walt contributed to the films. When one thinks of Walt Disney today, one may think that, well, he was just a kind of a name who supervised everything, but the real work was done by the animators. And in point of fact, when you look at those early animations, you see that Walt was involved in almost every frame of the film. Every single frame was the product of Walt Disney's mind, of Walt Disney's vision.
Neil Gabler, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much for asking me. I really appreciate it.
Neil Gabler's new biography is called Walt Disney, The Triumph of the American Imagination. Here's the scene from Pinocchio in which the puppet Pinocchio is brought to life by the blue fairy. Jiminy Cricket is listening in.
Am I a real boy?
No, Pinocchio. To make Geppetto's wish come true will be entirely up to you.
Up to me?
Prove yourself brave, truthful, and unselfish, and someday you will be a real boy.
A real boy?
That won't be easy.
You must learn to choose between right and wrong.
Right and wrong? But how will I know?
Polly, no.
Your conscience will tell you.
What are conscience?
What are conscience? Well, I'll tell you. A conscience is that still, small voice that people won't listen to. That's just the trouble with the world today.
Are you my conscience?
Who, me?
Would you like to be Pinocchio's conscience?
Well,
Very well. What is your name?
Cricket's the name. Jiminy Cricket.
Neil, Mr. Cricket.
Huh? No tricks now.
I dub you Pinocchio's conscience, Lord High Keeper of the knowledge of right and wrong, counselor in moments of temptation, and guide along the straight and narrow path.
Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward remembers rhythm and blues pioneer Floyd Dixon. He died over the summer. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
When Floyd Dixon died this past summer, the country lost one of the last great bluesmen of the late 40s and early 50s. Among his many accomplishments was convincing Ray Charles that he needed to stop imitating blues singer Charles Brown and start singing like Ray Charles. Rock historian Ed Ward has this tribute to an almost forgotten pioneer.
In 1945, 17-year-old Floyd Dixon moved back to Los Angeles from his hometown of Marshall, Texas. He'd first moved there with his family when he was 13, but he'd missed his dog, Jack, so he returned, lived in a treehouse, and got a job in a bowling alley where he ran into a piano player who called himself Roadmaster. He made good money setting bowling pins and turned it over to his grandmother, who eventually vanished with his life savings. When Jack the dog died, Floyd saw no alternative but to return to his parents, but thanks to Roadmaster, he'd acquired a skill. He could play the blues. This got him prizes at talent contests at the Million Dollar Theater and Johnny Otis's famed nightclub, The Barrel House. And soon he was rubbing shoulders with other musicians in his neighborhood, most notably Charles Brown, a fellow Texan and a major star of the day. He suggested that Floyd go see the Beharie brothers, who owned Modern Records, and show them what he could do. So he did.
Going down in Dallas, yes, that's the place for me. Yes, I'm going down in Dallas, yes, that's the place for me. There's someone down in Dallas that I really, really want to see. Well, I've been down in Oak Cliff.
Jules Beharie liked Dallas blues so much that he handed the kid $100 and told him to take it and go join the musicians' union immediately. It became one of 1949's most played rhythm and blues songs, as did his next record, Mississippi Blues. He made enough money to buy a station wagon to take him to gigs, and, eventually, enough to quit his day job at a sauerkraut factory. Eddie Williams was the bassist with Johnny Moore's Three Blazers, one of L.A.'s top blues acts, which fell apart when its vocalist Charles Brown went solo. Williams invited Floyd to join his new band, Eddie Williams and his Brown Buddies, who recorded for Supreme, a label owned by a black dentist named Al Patrick. Although the Brown Buddies had some hits for Supreme, Patrick declared bankruptcy and folded the label. But when Floyd went back to Modern, they proved they weren't happy with him by refusing to advance him $200 to bury his mother, who just died. In desperation, he turned to the notorious Don Roby, the Houston gambler who owned Duke Records. Roby gave him $2,000 to record 8 sides for him.
Hold that train, conductor. I'm coming right aboard. Hold that train, conductor. I'm coming right aboard. Being without my baby, here's the thing I can't afford. It'll be a real sad journey.
But, as he did so many others, Roby scared Dixon, and after Sad Journey had become successful, he had second thoughts about sticking with him and went to Aladdin Records in L.A., which bought Roby out. At long last, Floyd started to see some national success, and by the start of 1951, he was in the Rhythm and Blues top 10.
This is long distance.
Long distance, long distance. Try my baby once again. Long distance, long distance. Try my baby once again. Don't worry about the charges. I'll pay for everything on this end. Hello, pretty daddy. Please, please come back home.
A duet with Marie Wilson. Long-distance telephone blues made Floyd Dixon's career. Suddenly, songwriters were appearing with material for him, including a couple of teenagers named Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, whose Too Much Jelly Roll he recorded live at the Shrine Auditorium. But he also stuck with the tried and true and saw the top ten for the last time in 1952 with another telephone song, Call Operator 210.
Hello.
Hello, Floyd.
Hello, baby. Why did you wait so long to call? Hello, baby. Why did you wait so long to call? Well, I've been so sick and worried ever since you left last fall. Please, please.
Ironically, though, the song he'll probably be best remembered for wasn't a hit in its day and was cut in 1954 for a subsidiary of Atlantic called Cat. The royalties from its use in the Blues Brothers film certainly helped ease the pain of his old age.
Went bowling the other night, started drinking and got real tight. I blew each and all my friends, felt so good I had to blow again. I said, hey bartender, hey man, look here. Draw one, draw two, draw three, four glasses of beer. Saw a chick sitting on the end. I said, baby, can't we be friends? You're looking sweet as you can be. Come on down and drink with me. I said, hey, bartender.
Floyd Dixon continued to record for small labels, most recently for Alligator Records. By all accounts, he was a great storyteller and a devoted family man. He'll be missed.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Floyd Dixon died on July 26th. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli on the return of the British crime drama Cracker. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
It's been 10 years since Robbie Coltrane portrayed his signature TV character, crime psychologist Edward Fitzgerald, in the British series Cracker. But tonight, Coltrane and Cracker return in a new BBC America telemovie with an approach and a plot that are very pointedly post-9/11. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
If you've never seen Robbie Coltrane in Cracker, you've really missed something. His character, Dr. Edward Fitzgerald, goes by the friendly nickname of Fitz, but that's where the cuddly stuff stops. Back in 1993, when the Cracker series first was imported by PBS, Fitz was startlingly abrasive. For a police psychologist, he didn't care too much about other people's feelings. He was rude to his bosses and most of his colleagues, and treated his wife the same way. About the only people who got empathy from Fitz were his prime suspects. He understood them. And in his extended conversations with them in the interrogation room, he broke them down brilliantly. Back then, the only TV series close to Cracker in tone and intensity was NBC's Homicide: Life on the Street, which was introduced that same year. It also had a cop, Frank Pembleton, played by Andre Brower, who was a genius at extracting confessions. Frank was abrasive, but Fitz is even worse. He's got a drinking problem, he smokes, he's overweight, and he acts with undisguised arrogance, as if he were the smartest person in the room. He almost always is. Years ago, ABC tried an Americanized version of Cracker, starring Robert Pastorelli, who played the house painter on Murphy Brown. Terrible casting, terrible show. But these days on television, there's an obvious descendant of the Cracker character and sensibility. Hugh Laurie, playing an equal opportunity offender and a brilliant surgeon on the Fox series House. Fitz and House, it's easy to imagine, could almost be friends. Jimmy McGovern, the talented TV writer who's also responsible for the current BBC America miniseries The Street, seen on Tuesdays, wrote Cracker then. He's re-teamed with Coltrane for tonight's movie, which revisits the character a decade later. They agreed to do one more, Coltrane has explained, because McGovern found something new he wanted to explore. Boy, did he ever. The name of tonight's telemovie is Cracker, A New Terror, but that's only the title here in the United States. When it was shown back in the United Kingdom, its title was Cracker, 9/11. And the first murder victim in the drama is a visiting stand-up comic from America whose act made fun of the IRA for being overshadowed by Osama bin Laden. One of the unsettling things to absorb in this new Cracker is how openly everyone talks about being anti-American in general and anti-George W. Bush in particular. Not in any preachy political sense, but just as an accepted overall attitude. Even the American mother of the victim accepts as much, but insists that her son, a liberal comedian, was different. My son wasn't American, she insists, angry that he was targeted for murder. He was a New Yorker. In this telemovie, as in Columbo, whodunit isn't part of the mystery. We see the killer and the killing right away. The drama comes from watching the hero identify and then trap the murderer. But this time, there's just as much weight put on the motive. The killer is himself suicidal, but murders because he can't find the strength or the weakness to take his own life. And it's not revealing any of the key secrets in this new Cracker to reveal that the killer, years before, was a British soldier assigned to Northern Ireland. His post-traumatic stress disorder plays out in a desire to make someone pay for the deaths of his fellow soldiers. Deaths rendered less meaningful, he fears, after the global terrorism of 9/11. He directs his anger, his murderous rage, at Americans. And confronting a second potential victim, a wealthy businessman from the U.S., he takes the time to explain why. It's not coincidental that a news report from Iraq is playing on television at the time, or that the killer, while he's talking, raises the TV's volume to match his escalating rage and to mask the sounds of his victim.
What do you want?
I want revenge for every British soldier killed in Northern Ireland.
So?
So, I'm here.
I've never been to Northern Ireland.
Of course not. You're too frightened. Too many bombs going off, right?
Right.
Yeah. Bombs bought with American dollars. Every bullet that hit every British soldier bought with American dollars. Every bomb bought with American dollars. Every... You're not listening.
I am.
The fact is, I don't think Basra is Baghdad.
You funded terrorism for years. Then hallelujah. You get what's coming to you. 9/11. And suddenly you don't like terrorism one little bit. I call that hypocrisy.
The hunt for this killer is exciting. And the acting, by Anthony Flanagan as the troubled ex-soldier, and especially by Coltrane as Fitz, couldn't be better. It takes a long time for Fitz to identify his prime suspect. But when the two of them wind up in that interrogation room, it's terrific. Fitz follows an expected line of questioning with a seemingly unrelated one.
What did you think of 9/11?
What?
What did you think about 9/11?
What's that got to do with it?
Well, what did you think?
As it turns out, everything. For a valuable perspective about that tragedy that you're not likely to see anywhere on scripted TV in the United States, make sure to watch tonight's Cracker on BBC America. The title has been diluted, but the drama and the message arrive in full force.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Vertigo, a novel of suspense set in Victorian England by Lauren Baratz Logstedt. From Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with journalist James Traub, author of the new book, The Best Intentions, Kofi Annan and the UN in an Era of American World Power. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.